think that's what we were hoping to share tonight, kind of the innovation journey, and, you know, Andres maybe can kick it off and tell us a little bit about Seiko, just, you know, set the level set for everybody, and, you know, kind of how you came about the, because it started with him the same way, coming over here with, you know, seeing what's going on.
Well, I guess, first of all, we need to start seeing where are we. I mean, this is manufacturing industry, machining, basically. And that is about a $360 billion U.S. dollar industry overall. Where we are as Seiko, we're in the tooling business, which is basically $16, $17 billion, part of that industry. We are a Seiko top five in that industry. It's very, very mature. Most of the top 10 companies, I'd say all of them, actually started back in the 1920s. So we have a very mature core technology in there, which, of course, affects all of these companies, because today they're looking into, so, okay, what will we do with all this digital stuff? Then the customer space is very wide, from small mom-and-pop shops, basically, over to the BMWs, the Rolls-Royces. So you have to cater to this whole public, of which some of these companies are very advanced and some don't want to have anything to do with this technology. So you still have to cater to all that space. So what we did in 2015 in the leadership team, we started asking ourselves, okay, so how are we going to approach this? And how does this digital part go together with the sort of the innovation thinking in the company? And also we realized that we can't just listen to our customers. That won't do. We have fairly intimate connections to our customers. We're the branding promise of our brand promise is really being competent and practical, so we're out there. However, this was not really only listening to the customers. So we wanted to have an idea of what was going on. And we partnered up with a company or a network that provided what you can call were learning expeditions. So we actually took the whole leadership team and put the leadership team into different places. A little bit of that, what you mentioned, which you were sort of a little bit critical to, hey, I mean, what kind of this innovation tour or whatever. But over 5 to 7 days, you actually sit down, and it's very well structured. You're not just going around. You're actually having dialogues and conversations with GE, Cisco, you know, Alphabet, whatever, and down to, in our case, you know, small workshops here in San Francisco. So it was sort of a very wide perspective of that when we were here, because this is the place when one of the first these learning expeditions took place.
So you also, is this the same as innovation excursion, too?
Yeah.
And was that altimeter? Were they the ones that...
No. This was not altimeter.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You refer to something that...
There are several companies doing this kind of sort of facilitation.
I think we're critical when they come here just for the fun of it. But clearly, for you, it was more important. It was the senior management who came here, and it was part of something bigger, something more serious.
So we really wanted to dip into not only here, but understanding. And we have done this in India. We've done it in Germany, just to understand. We will continue to do this kind of thing. But from here, so essentially, we, after a week, we said, okay, so we need to do something very clearly. We got, you can say that, we got influenced by the atmosphere or whatever. So we took basically three decisions on, okay, so we are going to do three things. One is we're going to set up a consultancy business. That is not part of what we do generally. I'm heading up that consultancy. And we're going to do something around open innovation. And it was basically over to the VP of R&D, and I held that position at that point to do something. And, you know, Jim, you were one of the facilitators on during that week as well. So after a period of time when we were trying to we're going to do something, but exactly how are we going to do this and what are we going to do about it? And that's where sort of really the thinking started. So, you know, where do we want to be? What is the ultimate end game for the innovation? And where do we want to have? Do we want to attack the innovation culture in the company? Do we want to find specific new products? What is it? Mm-hmm. And I think that is essentially a very important point in when you're going to, if you're going to decide to go here, what are you actually after?
So that was after the trip. Now, who were part of the trip? There was a whole senior leadership
team. The whole leadership team, yes.
Okay.
From CFO to, you know,
what preparations did you do back home before you came? Because that's one thing that I find. A lot of these delegations, they don't do the homework.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, do your homework. Mm-hmm. Find out, you know, when you meet with companies, find out what they're doing and so on.
So this
is, you get more out of it.
Right. So this is one of the things this facilitator firm actually provided, you know, bios, write-ups, whatever, on all the companies. And we were really, there was basically a structure to this, you know, when you meet a company like that, okay, so what are, you had roles in the group, I mean, you were the interviewer, you were supposed to do a video at the end, I was taking notes, and this was in the leadership team with, I would say, we were nine at the time, with at least 25 years of experience.
Wow. Okay.
So that was sort of 200 years of experience just walking around saying, well, actually, I'm just taking notes at this meeting. I'm not asking a single question. And that brought, you know, brought back, we split it up in three teams, and we really could compare at the end of the day because it was so structured. So what did you actually learn during this day? Could you please relate that to the rest of the group? So rather than having them transferring all the nine around, it was like, okay, so we have three groups, you know.
So you had to debrief each day.
The reflection part, I think, is what was really different. Yeah. The preparation was different, but the reflection. Because a lot of folks come here, and it just goes by so fast.
Oh, yeah.
And then they go home, and they can't remember it all blended together. So they force them, because at the end of the day, it's like, so what did we learn today? What can we take away from it? It's very structured methodology, I think.
Okay.
So I would say there's 180 degrees different from the folks that just come over kind of underprepared and leave overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Right.
So there's, and what we did as well, we wrote a very clear business brief before we came.
Okay.
This was like four pages of where are we today, where are we going to be in 2020, whatever it was then, 2022 or something like that. So we actually had something to match against. You know, okay, so what do we believe and which of the gaps that we had already identified did we actually believe that these sort of reflections had a bearing on?
So you knew a fair bit about the valley then to see, you know, what kinds of things that you wanted to focus on.
I would say we had an idea, but we didn't know about it.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's a little bit different versus folks that just want to check off to the board that they're doing something with innovation. You see a lot of these, right? I think what we call it, the famous one, they spent $100 million on their open innovation lab. They finally shut it down after blowing through $100 million. There's really nothing to show for them. So I think you guys definitely had a little bit more kind of focus with, you knew the customer, some of the customer challenges, and so you're trying to solve those. I think so when we talk about sensors and what came out of it, there was a little bit more tied, wasn't so abstract, just innovation for innovation's sake. And that would be advice I would give others as well. Don't just come over here and think, oh, we're just going to become innovative, and not just an elite, you know, group of the folks that have been selected to be the innovators, right? Often companies reward, you know, a certain group of people, oh, you can be the innovation team or whatever. And it's just too isolated. It's not part of transforming the entire organization. So I think you guys took a little bit different, smarter approach.
So when you got back then, so you spent this time here, you did the debriefs, mm-hmm. and you learned a lot, mm-hmm. and then when you went back, what happened, and how did you formulate the plan for, you know, what
we actually sort of wrote out the plan here, say, okay, these are the first steps we're going to take.
Okay.
And then we put those in motion as soon as we got home.
Oh.
So we actually took out and created a group of people that were supposed to head up the consultancy out of the organization, very small from the start, trying to formulate, so what are we going to deliver exactly. I got charged with, okay, so how are we going to access the Open Innovation Network? And I bounced some ideas with Eugene, and what we really tried to formulate was, okay, so what, if we're going to do something, what resonates with our company? What resonates with the culture? What do we want to change in the culture or apart from that? And quite quickly, we came to the conclusion we're not really interested in tapping into startups.
Right.
That was not what we were after.
Okay.
We wanted to, on a broader sense, actually move sort of, with quotation marks, innovation from R&D to the general company. And that was, you know, one of the things that I would say is still in the plan for the end games. And how do you spread this?
So were you focused, did you really want to focus on kind of radical innovation as opposed to, say, Norway, when they talk about innovation, oh, yeah, we're doing innovation. The R&D team is doing it, but it's incremental,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's not, they don't look at new business models, they don't look at radical changes in the use of data and so on. So did you early on decide we're going to be radical, not just...
We actually kept away from any kind of discussion on radical, breakthrough, incremental.
Okay.
Because what we were after were basically a couple of things inside a company. We wanted, we want to have an idea how you find and operate an innovation network.
Okay.
You could call that way of working. We wanted to introduce another way of working with our general development rather than doing sort of stage gate, for those of you who are familiar with that, or with the more agile for hardware. And we also sent Quentin and the team over with a fairly broad scope of come home with two MVPs.
Okay.
But we didn't specify what. We said it needs to be something that is combining hardware and software.
Minimally viable product.
Yeah. And we call it sensor, sensor equipped tooling at the point, which doesn't mean very much. But we really stepped away from saying it needs to be radical. It was much more, if you put this in this environment, it's going to be outside in.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the key points for us.
Okay.
Has the company ever tried anything like this before?
No, nothing.
Whose idea was
it? It was from the leadership team saying we need to do something. I was given the task, we need to do something with open innovation that is outside in. Go do it.
But is this a tradition to do every year to go out on these excursions?
Yes, we have had that over the past
year. It's a really good thing to do to get out there.
You take excursions to other places before you came here.
We had not. This was the first. This was the first.
So Bangalore came after.
Yes, Bangalore came afterwards. Munich came after that, et cetera, et cetera. So we were in Chicago in September.
What was the state of the company that led the leadership team and yourself to say,
we got rid of my business. We're doing well.
There are 15 people, or there are five companies that dominate the business that we're in, and nothing changes radically. Everybody makes money.
Yeah, this wasn't born out of a crisis, right? There wasn't an existential crisis. We have to do something to survive. So that's actually kind of interesting. They were doing well at the time, right? There was nothing wrong with the business.
Well, that's a good time to do it, though, when you're doing well.
Was it a rainy day or a sunny day?
Yeah. I think it was more the realization that definitely a lot of stuff is going on.
Mm.
And it's very dangerous to be locked into a niche. I mean, we're very profitable for being in a business where you're dealing with basically machining. This company is very profitable. We've had basically an unbroken, take away 2009, but an unbroken sort of increase in revenue over I don't know how many years. So it wasn't crisis at all, but it was more realization in that leadership team that something, if that is going to happen 2017 or 2022 or 2028, it doesn't really matter because, we need to start now to change because it's a long journey. This is nothing that you do and say, well, we're going to be complete in 18 months. This is a five-year journey, whatever it is, right?
You said earlier that you felt you had a pretty good understanding of customers, you were close with the customer, but you also said that you wanted to bring customers into our shared innovation spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting. Was that something that came out of the trip here, or how did you get about that? Hey, we need to do open innovation, bring customers in and work with the customers and I assume also outside partners. That's part of open innovation.
Sure.
To bring everyone in and reckon that you can't do it all by yourself.
We have tried, and this is a little bit particular for this industry, there's very little true collaboration or common projects, longer term projects with customers. You solve customer problems. But other industries where I work, we had direct contact with the R&D part, for instance, of BMW. Here we don't have that, and actually none in the business has that. So it's a little bit particular in that sense. So we were looking for not necessarily R&D, but that comes, so how do we bring customers closer? How are we getting closer to the customers? How can we do that? I wouldn't say that we are super successful today with that, but it's still there that is something we would want to do.
Right. But now, given what you're doing and what came out of all of this, now you're collecting all a lot of data, and so now you're learning even more about the customers, how they're using your product.
Hopefully, we will.
We'll get to that later. But that's, I think, what a lot of companies are realizing, that hey, if they have this data and can utilize that better, they will understand the customer in a totally different way. And co-creation, I think most companies realize if you can co-create something with the customer, it's going to be a lot more successful than if you go and do it by yourself.
As a startup, we would say get the product market fit, right? So that part of the DNA of a startup, you got to figure out if you got something the customer wants. I think when you're a mature company, you're kind of used to doing incremental improvements, and so a little bit different. And I think you also get these, I don't know if it's McKinsey, the Boston Consulting Group, said you have to have a digital strategy. Look at the Fortune 500. Everybody on there is a digital company. We no longer is there an Exxon or Mobil on there. And so I think that's one of the challenges that starts to drive people from the traditional businesses. What is the data that is meaningful? What would I do with that? And if I was a digital company, so I think for a lot of traditional companies, IT are the people that came and fixed the printer. It wasn't really a fundamental part of our business that is for Google or even an Amazon, right? The customer experience. So easy to say, harder to do. I think that's what if you drop that off in front of the management, say, all right, you're going to have a digital strategy. What is that, right? I think that part is a big challenge.
We haven't talked about culture yet, but. Some people say that culture eats strategy for breakfast, and it's really, really important if you're going to be successful. And culture varies quite a bit. I have a friend who runs a Finnish company that was acquired by a very different company from France, and with a totally different culture, and that was difficult.
We didn't have any cultural issues, did we?
You had none.
This is a big hierarchical French company. I'm sure there's different cultures in smaller companies in France, but the traditional hierarchical company coming in. What's the culture? Did you feel that you had the right culture, or did you feel that you also needed to change the culture?
Culture is generally your journey, right? I mean, you're changing it basically all the time, even if you aim for it or not. Something that we really wanted to do was to get more outside in, to actually show that partnership open actually have a value to the company. So to say, if that is part of culture or core values or whatever, that is one thing that we actually wanted and still want to change. Because, again, this is a journey. I mean, you're going to talk about that. We've sort of done it once, and it really affects the company, but it's still a journey. How do we continue that journey? On the culture note, I think it's really important to know and you mentioned digital strategy before. For me, the main thing with digital is you really need to understand where do you want to have this leverage. Is it going to be customer facing? Is it going to be internal efficiency? What is digital to you and your company? Or maybe it's both. Or even do you want to use digital to change the culture in terms of internal communication or whatever it is? If that is called a strategy or not, I don't really care. It depends more or less on the company what you call it. We have no digital strategy specifically.
Seiko is a wonderful example of a company with a strong culture. The people that work there stay there for a long time. They know they're working for the leaders in the industry. I think you were with the company for 15 years, right, when this happened to you, when it was first job out of college. So I think that there's a lot of pride in what the company does, a lot of pride in keeping a happy customer base. So to me, it was a wonderful place to start because you already had a great company culture, and now you want to expand or evolve it or change it in some way. A lot of companies start off with a very terrible company culture. So that's, I think, is a deficit. So in this case, Seiko had a very proud, strong quality.
Did you share with the whole, everyone in the company knew what was going on?
Everyone in the company did not know what was going on. But, fair in mind, that we didn't sort of publicize this and say, now we're going to San Francisco. No, that we didn't.
Everyone wanted to go.
Yeah, right. No, we did not do that. But we were fairly frank and open about it. Okay, yeah, this is happening, and also why it was happening.
And people bought into it. There was general support. Well, with the nervousness, what is this going to do to us?
I think it was more, but maybe you can answer that better than I can. It was more, well, okay, on one hand, finally we're doing something, which is, you know, different from what we have done over the past, whatever, years.
Right.
I think that was one reaction. The other reaction is, okay, so, you know, is this just something that we're doing as a plaything, or is this gonna, what's going to happen when these guys come back? I think the most important one, I mean, there was a very senior leadership behind this across the board. And I think that is, so all these leaders actually talked to their own organizations, you know, saying, well, okay, we're doing it for a reason.
Right.
It's not just something that these crazy R&D guys came up with.
So when you came back, did you then share, okay, we've been traveling now, we've been looking into these things, and
we've been communicating
what we are now going to do, and people were on board with
that. We have been communicating, you know, what happened there, where are we going now, etc. And that is probably one of the lessons learned for us, is that we could have done more of that.
Okay.
Absolutely. And in a better way. I mean, this was very much a learning process as well.
Yeah.
But
to share with,
where did they have the only food in Oregon?
If you look at, we have R&D in 8 countries. Fairly spread out. We have, if you look at the business level, we have 45 wholly owned subsidiaries around the world. So we're global. We're 4,500 people. So it's not a super 800 million U.S. revenue.
Now, to get back to the culture thing, apparently you decided early on, or at least I haven't heard the word acquisitions mentioned at all. So is that has not been on the table? You think they will do organic growth as opposed to acquiring? We have some companies down here like Cisco and Google and so on. The big part of how they innovate and so on is...
Mm-hmm.
You know, looking for companies that they can acquire.
We wouldn't have sort of an M&A strategy at that point that pointed to technology, specifically not digital, because since we knew so little about it ourselves, it's really hard to go out and acquire anything that makes any sense. That is our standpoint at that point. Now we actually have we have an M&A strategy, and actually we did an M&A 2 weeks ago. In China, but that was more sort of standard core business. That also aims towards this part. But we are still more likely to open for partnerships than to do M&A in the digital space, because still we don't really know what we're going to do with an acquisition in that space. So it's much better for us to sort of look at, okay, so how can we partner up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're trying to... Part of the changing the organization, I would say, is an outsider doing it themselves internally, kind of gave everybody ownership. When Quinton came home, this is what we made. Yeah. It wasn't something that some other company made and we acquired it, or we hired it out to an SRI. So a lot of people do go to that, you know, the IDOs of the world or whatever. So I think that helped helped with some internal acceptance. This is something that our own people built.
Yeah. If you can do it internally. You know, that I have looked at innovation outposts.
Yeah.
People that come, companies that come here, and I talked to this one Japanese guy who was so funny. He was talking about his organization came here and he wanted to do a certain thing, and the people back home would say, "Are you crazy? You can't do that. That's crazy." He wanted to create a motorcycle that a robot could ride the motorcycle. And no one would buy into it. Said, "You're crazy? No way." So then that's when he went to SRI.
Mm-hmm.
SRI put a team of a dozen engineers on it. 6 months later, they had a robot driving the damn motorcycle to gather, and again, to the data part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Gathering data and seeing what the issues were, things that you couldn't do when a person was riding the motorcycle. So there was a definite purpose in building this robot that could drive the motorcycle. And then once it was successful, then everyone back home wanted to be on the project. Mm-hmm. So that okay. But sometimes it's hard. You can't do it internally. So you go to somewhere else to do it.
I think this is a great point, because there is no one solution to this.
No.
You know, And there was actually a pretty good report, probably a year old, by the Crowd Company, a short one that lists sort of 10 typical avenues for how to access open innovation, right, in one or another way. And for me, it's not covering everything, but those 10 different ways are actually quite interesting to look at for any company. Because then you get a really good idea, okay, so how are we going to blend this? Are we going to choose one? You know, is it Walmart Black Ops kind of thing, or is it Innovation Outpost, or whatever it is? So, I mean, that's really required. Start thinking about what you want to do.
Yeah. If you ask people in big companies, how should we become more innovative? By far, most people say, oh, we should do something with startups, or act like a startup, or have an innovation outpost, have a venture capital arm, and invest in startups. You know, Flextronics invested in 26 startups. I got to tell you, none of that changed the parent company. You have the startup, you invest in them, you see them once a month at the board meeting, they're doing some interesting things, but it's hard for that to then come back in and change the behavior of the parent. Right?
What is happening around here with a lot of companies is that the big companies meet the small companies in accelerators.
Yes.
And I think there is some logic to that. I think that when accelerators have vertical programs, could be retail, could be IoT, could be different things, and then you bring the big and the small together. And the small ones have different ideas. It doesn't mean the big ones have to acquire the small ones. They could make an investment in them, but they're learning from it. So this learning thing is a very important part.
Mm.
Whether it's a learning excursion or, you know, learning about how the world is changing.
Right.
What are the business opportunities that are coming out of that?
Mm.
So,
I think that there's a lot of dialogue back and forth. Do you want the corporate antibodies to kill the thing that you just bought and now we're trying to integrate? I hear a lot of trends now. Let's keep it a separate startup and not try to mess with it. It's running fine. So, you know, if you look at Zappos and Amazon, right, they didn't really put their fingerprints all over it. Ran it the same way that it was run beforehand. So I think that there's no right or wrong way, but that's actually one of the challenges. If I acquired the company, I could almost kill it too, right?
Sure.
And we've seen plenty of examples of that.
Was one of the four on the formative memo that was written about the results of the trip. Was one of the four items we need to do this every year, and here's a list of places we should go.
We actually all wrote out the business brief before, and what was in that, it was not saying anything about how. It was more saying about what are the gaps that we want to close. So that memo didn't tell anyone, okay, so how should we do it? That was sort of coming after the visit here, so let's come up with. What we have after that done is that we have I wouldn't say a roadmap, but we have a direction, what we want to do, to bring many more in the company in the position so they can actually develop their own ideas.
Uh-huh.
And that was also a mainstream thought.
So a different team went to
Bangalore? No, I mean, the teams here, that was actually the leadership team I was referring to. We haven't sent any other teams like this away. We have only sent one to San Francisco so far. And, yeah.
Maybe that's a good way to transition.
Yeah.
How's your turn, Quentin? I want to hear your story from, you know, from how you were picked and how you made that decision. It must have been a very hard decision. You come here for 6 months. And did you have family that came with you?
No, I came alone.
Oh, that made it a little easier, you know? Because that's the hard part. You know,
one of the guys brought his wife and 1 year old son with him.
So he had kids that you need to place in school and so that whole issue is can be a tricky one to bring people over when you have bigger innovation households that you put together. But anyway, why don't we hear a little bit about, you know, how you see things, how you felt about being part of this, and
I thought he's a real friend.
Tell it like it is.
This is off the record, right?
This is off the record. This is only for
me. No, this is original for you. So it's the right to on my table like that. It's been one day my manager, which was basically I was based in France, and my direct manager was located in Sweden.
Okay.
So he phoned me, say, hey, will you be interested to join a new project around sensor, IoT technology? So first of all, I asked him, what does it mean, IoT? Because my background is a mechanical engineer and product development. And I say, yeah, the challenge is this project, it will be 6 months in San Francisco.
Oh, it could be, and it could be worse places to come. Right?
So my first answer to him is, when should I start the project? So for me, my personal feeling from several years, I would love to live during some longer period in a foreign country. And U.S. was one of my favorite countries to live this type of experience. So it's quite, for me, extremely easy to say, yes, I want to come. But after, when I received the project description, in fact, it was extremely basic. Okay, the title of the project was Sensor Equipped Tooling. So, like you said, it means almost nothing. And, okay, you have to explore agile metal. So that is something completely unknown for me, compared to our previous way of managing projects. You need to develop some prototypes connected with some sensor based on our activity. So that's okay, I'm an engineer, so yeah, let's try it, even if I have a ton of questions. And the last one was, okay, you have to develop the networking. So you will be based in San Francisco, so automatically we need to create some connection, we need to discover.
So on the networking, we say here that networking is the oil of Silicon Valley. That's what makes it work. In France, and particularly in the big cities, is there a lot of networking? Did you do networking before you came here?
So first of all, my site were in France located in Bourges. So Bourges is a very small town, I would say 3 hours to the south of Paris, middle of nowhere. So the size of the
no networking.
So it's,
so it's 18,000 people. So for France, it's a small town. For Sweden, it's a big town, but no, it's very small. So it means there is no networking at all, or it's extremely local. No, we don't have this type of thing. And the networking, all our networking is more connected to university, because I'm an engineer for 5 years of university, so we develop our own network. And we have our network on industry. So it means we know a lot of people from different companies, from major one, Airbus, Renault, and this type of company. And that's it. But now we don't have this type of meeting.
One of the things we actually noticed right away is they don't carry business cards with them, and they're not trying to link in with everybody. They actually had to make a contest out of it.
Yeah, we had some of them, but after 2 weeks, we were run out of business cards.
Well, they would last them for a year, and then France was gone in a week here. And if we saw some regional or national affiliates, so the Swedish guys like the Silicon Vikings meetups. Him being French, you like the French, tech hub breakfasts and all that kind of stuff.
So did you identify organizations, or how did you go about networking?
We used gym background.
Okay.
It was easy and quick solution for us.
And just as everyone, we sat in the Flex Mini Factory in downtown San Francisco. So right. That constant flow of people coming in from all over the place. So
right.
Just sitting there, you're going to be interrupted by me and say, hey, give this guy a card, he's from wherever, right? And so I think they just couldn't get away from being bombarded with newcomers and people that wanted to, say hi and shake hands and all that. So I think the venue where you sit might have something to do with it. Because
right.
That's one of the things I think is a negative. A lot of people coming over and doing their innovation outposts, they create their own little closed door place, and then if nobody's there, it's like a ghost town. But we have an innovation outpost, and I see more
of
it.
Well, see, that's why the advantage is made you to be in an accelerator, and just plug and play or whatever, where there's a lot of traffic, a lot of people coming in, a lot of dynamic things going on.
Programs going on, whether it's a rocket space or, Y Combinator, having that kind of methodology and exposure, I think, is definitely something. You don't want to just come here and sit in your own little world.
Right.
One of the things they found out, too, is how many people they meet internationally here. It's the center of the universe. So if you're going to be at an IoT show, you're going to come from all over the world. So he met a lot of French companies at the French, tech hub. So it's
why do we have to come all the way from France to Silicon Valley to meet people from France, right?
I mean, in one way, so maybe that it's I don't think it's a problem. But in our job, on our regular way of doing things, it's not to our position. So my position was a project manager on R&D, about R&D project, and my role is not to create some networking. I have to drive and manage a project and do some support the designer, do some tests in our lab and follow the project in the complete up. So it was quite basic, and it's not our role to do some networking.
No.
So that's it. It's like that. So okay, if we are curious, we can create some leads.
But part of the project, I think you said, was to change the way you're working also, mm-hmm. to look at.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of companies, and that's really interesting. That was a meeting we had a month ago in Palo Alto, looked at the future work, mm-hmm. how work is being done, how you operate,
mm-hmm.
and changing that. And that's where digital technology comes in. You can do things differently.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at how you worked before, now you were in a certain place where there was no networking and so on, but have you also changed? Are you now doing things differently, using digital tools?
Yeah, definitely. So when I saw the target, I think, it was a kind of a lot of freedom. We can manage to work when we want. And the fact is, we move from Europe, where everybody is located in our company, or most of the people here. So we were three guys. And after 10 o'clock in the morning, we are completely free to do whatever we want in the rest of the day. So at least for me, it was extremely comfortable to be able to manage my time how I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I know for my colleagues it was maybe a little bit more challenging, but we have to try it. The project, we have to test something different, and on the agile method, we learn, okay? It's a lot to fail. In Europe, the fact to fail is dramatic. It's very bad. If I manage a project that I fail because we don't achieve the forecast, it could be dramatic for you, for your career, for your reputation. But here, when you arrive here, if you fail, okay, you fail, but tomorrow you will win.
What did you learn?
It's something the experience say, it's a lot to fail, so it's something extremely interesting. So me, I just apply what I learned.
So were there surprises? What kinds of surprises did you learn in the period that you were here? And you probably came with certain expectations on how this place operates and what you would find. And when you look back at it, were there anything that stands out that was a big surprise and how... Would you found here?
In fact, I arrived with a mindset, it will be different compared to what I used to live. And I need to follow the trend and...
Just go with the flow.
I just follow the flow. I didn't set any... When the first day of work, I didn't arrive. At the end of the 6 months, I want to achieve to that. I say, I will discover new things, I will learn new things. And I expect to be able to propose some results.
Right.
Of course, I want to, even if it's a lot to fail, I want to succeed in one way. So, but I didn't know what to do. It arrived maybe 1 month, 1 month and a half after we arrived. After learning, fighting a little bit with Jim at some point. When I say we need to propose, we need to set a strategy according which is compatible with our time frame. Because 6 months it looks like quite long. It's long when you are far away from your family and things like that, but in fact it's extremely short. and you run, you spend 1 month just because it's nice, everything is so new. So, and I thought, okay, so now it's just 5 months remaining, so it's on our business, it's quite normal. It's one iteration for one prototype cycle for, you know, 5 months in our business. And, you know, in fact, in 5 months, we did, 10 different tests on different topics. And
I don't know if something watching them, but I think, you know, a lot of big companies, we hire for a function that we have.
Right.
We want somebody who's got a mechanical engineering background, going to work in R&D and do these things. I don't think Quentin was hired because of his marketing communication skills. But come to find out, when you give someone permission to be creative, and there's no departments telling you not to do that and stay in your lane, come to find out this guy makes wicked videos. They're really funny and great and, you know, very communicative and all that. So he found that a very convenient way to talk to the steering committee every 3 weeks, right? But who would have thought, because we didn't hire him because he had a video editing background, he was a really good mechanical engineer. So I think, given the opportunity to flourish, the human spirit is really amazing in that respect. So a lot of, I think, corporate change and change of behavior is just giving people permission to fail, to experiment, to fill out their own creative potential. And I think a lot of times you don't realize that that's what we do in big companies, because you got this job description and you're hired now to be in the marketing department. That's your area of expertise.
Do you think that being here in Silicon Valley had a smell, as opposed to maybe moving to another town in France where he was alone by himself?
I don't know. There was sort of a going a little bit backwards on that one. We had a selection process and some criteria for why we were sending people, you know, how. Okay, so we said they're not supposed to know each other. They're not supposed to be in their home country. They're supposed to come from different units, different product lines. They're also supposed to be experienced project managers, knowing our product very well, but essentially no requirement on knowing anything about IoT or whatever. And then taking these outside their home environment, don't try to put, you know, something into France when we have one French guy in there, because, you know, that person will be at home, even if they're outside their unit. So, you know, taking this crew and putting them into the, it could have been China, right? It doesn't, you know, necessarily need to be Silicon Valley, but just bringing them out of the home and removing the shackles of, you know, you don't have to go through, and you have an excellent example of that, but you don't have to go through procurement. You can go out and, you know, to Radio Shack and you know, just buy stuff.
Yeah.
You don't have to ask anyone. You don't have to ask your manager. So what's the credit limit? Can I buy something for $50? Just decide, right? You have your budget of the project, you know, which was sort of in the million-dollar frame. So, you know, that, I think, was much more important in the sense of freedom and allowing people to do. But, of course, at the same time, very hard, because this was out of, cut all out of your comfort zone, at least in the beginning.
Oh, yeah, we are.
You were comfortable.
No. Not entirely.
not entirely, enough, but at least for me, then I can't talk for my colleagues, but for me, yeah, I will live a dream during 6 months in a fantastic place. So I just have to do my best, follow the flow, and yeah, after a few weeks, based on our experience, say, okay, we need to set a plan, and we propose a plan, and more time we spend on this plan, more logical it became, and during all our team committee, we most of the time we asked for some questions. And basically, after each steering committee, we didn't get any answer. So we continue.
Right.
Say, okay, we have to go. So, okay, if it was my company, okay, I will take this decision. So, and we continue like that, and we arrive to this result of item.
But working in a Scrum environment and Agile is a lot different than the way, and so we actually train the managers as well. And I would say, put word into his mouth, he could never go back again. So once you infect somebody with the entrepreneurial virus, they're used to exponential, you know, movements and going quickly, you can't go back and go into the slow lane again. When you're used to driving fast, so I would put words in and say, The big transformation is he's never going to go back to the way he did things, the old way. He's now bitten by the virus or infected or whatever you want to call it, but I think that that's changed your way of thinking about the future of work, right? The nature of work.
Can you go back to your 18,000 person small town?
No. I'm never going back because I'm tired of this fantastic experience. So, just for the joke, 2 weeks before my manager contacted me for this project, so with my wife, we plan our wedding.
Oh, nice.
So if you're doing all this day in parallel of this quite heavy project, I have to prepare everything for the wedding, and just 2 weeks after I come back in Europe, so we have the wedding, which was quite challenging because it's private.
Yeah.
And now we are living in Switzerland. So I'm going to come back.
So let's. I'd love to hear a little bit about the project, what ended up, and we'll get to that. But before we do that, I think you mentioned that, you know, if you do these annual innovation excursions, and what's next, and what do you see the company doing now, and are there certain parts of the world that you think are particularly interesting? Is it Shenzhen, or is it Sao Paulo, or, you know, what are some of the things that you see out on the horizon that you think could be particularly interesting for your company now, given what you've been through, and given that you want to kind of, you know, get out there and build these networks and do open innovation? That's a, it's a big world out there, and it's changing quickly.
It is. Like I said, I mean, this is, it's not part of a grand master plan, but it's more part of the direction.
Right.
One is, obviously, that we keep in touch. We actually have our SMGC at Pier 9 here, so we are going to stay in touch with Silicon Valley. The next step here is probably not to send a team here, but rather to send a team into a different environment, and this time we might actually choose France, because the setup might be a little bit different. We want probably to pull people through on a more regular basis rather than to have a team there for 6 months. And this could be like, hey, we would like to offer our engineers the possibility that when they're on the bench, we're between projects, actually you can pick up your ideas and could you develop, your idea in 3 months, really 3 weeks and come up with something. That you cannot do inside the company as it is today. So we're about signing a contract with Tech Shop in France, in Paris.
Okay.
So that is another sort of one of these innovation hubs that we would like to tie into. And then on the overall part of innovation, we are supporting our ideation part and really the exploration part, and then where we are moving from, I would say, not knowing today, it's really the exploitation. If this comes out again, if we sort of come to the same points where we are with what you're going to talk about, so how do we do that in a more efficient way than we did the last time? Because the exploitation is probably, for a mature company, maybe the hardest part, if it doesn't fall inside your traditional sort of product space.
Mm.
How do you do that? Do you spin off? We haven't done that. We've found the middle way here, So we're sort of trying to work on those three, ideation, exploration, and exploitation kind of avenues, and say, so how do we do that? At the same time, really involving many more in the company on the innovation journey.
Mm.
That's where we are right now.
Very good.
So, this is a team sport. If we can bring it across the company in a totally different way and tap into the potential there, it is, and that's actually a core belief that we have. It goes back to the values that we have. It goes back to the whole organizational development we want to run, because our core belief is people actually want to contribute. If they're given the chance, they will. And that is a very firm core belief that we have in Syncore. And we try to live that.
Yeah. We have a rule on these events that we split half of the time with the panelists and half with the audience. Because I go to too many meetings in Silicon Valley when they at the end they say, "Oh, we got 5 minutes for questions," you know, and that's really not fair at all. So now is your chance to ask questions and get involved. And I'm sure you have a bunch of questions now based on what you heard. And so feel free to.
Work for the company, but in Sweden. Yeah. Are you going back to a challenge that you left behind in France? Taking
that
no. Or parachuting or something completely different? No, in fact, from this journey, so we propose different strategy, different challenge, technical challenge. And the first level was the tool identification. We call now IDEM, and when we come back, on that say, okay, we have to continue this development, we have to propose a solution, and I took the lead of this
activity. So the
project
started here,
they have a new logo, and they have a new product. Mm-hmm. For the first time, they're selling something that isn't a machine tool. Right? Mm-hmm. So now you sell a piece of plastic with a printed circuit board on the inside with antennas and talks to mobile apps and cloud services, so there's a brand new unit now. It didn't exist a year ago.
Well, it's a separate unit in the company.
Yeah.
And it's not part of the project.
It's not branded Takeoff. It's a brand new independent logo in order to differentiate to the customer. Well, this is something different. It's built by Takeoff. They're not hiding that.
Right.
But it's a completely different now digital business.
So is this the expected outcome of
We had a broad sort of yes, you got to go into, and like Clinton said, it could be anything, but we didn't set an expectation on, should we start a new business unit, whatever, because we weren't sure. So the fact of the matter was that once we saw that this was a potential, we decided to move into what we call secret consultancy. But no.
But it might be one of the magic, lucky, we're lucky in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. We saw each other in June in Poland, and we are starting to think pretty excited over here. We're onto something, right? We really have something that could be. And then Andrew said, these guys are telling me that they got stuff that could be patentable. Isn't that the craziest thing? We've only been there a couple of months. I'm like, no, it's actually not the craziest thing. We've found some things. So it's the serendipity of the journey. You're walking down the road, and there you find a chunk of gold, and you say, wow, we're in the gold business now. So I think that was just, serendipity that you came up with something. It was a problem they were solving. They knew they had a problem that they had solved that the customers wanted.
I try. I took some risk. I said yes, continue. Don't tell that. We got a budget to continue the activity. Definitely.
But that's the difference between a startup. You had a minimally viable product by Seiko standards, the big company standards. It wasn't complete. It wasn't fucked out. It wasn't all ready to go. So I think that part they did inherit a little bit less. Mm-hmm. Advanced, the minimally viable product was now good enough to keep on going, which a startup would do, right? Mm-hmm.
And so we arrived to this result. Maybe it's the analysis of different parameters. So if you come back to the initial title of the project, sensor quick tooling, it's extremely easy to say, okay, I will put a ton of sensor on one cutter or one tool we used to produce for now a decade, and we see. What we will see. It's extremely easy to say, okay, let's do it, but that it's a journey of several years before to deliver something ready to be on the field. And the first thing we learn about that is, okay, if we want to make something durable, we need to deliver something which is easy to implement on minimal time or in few months or a few years. So it's why we arrive and say, okay, we need to find an idea which is extremely basic, maybe which looks like probably completely stupid, but we know that it will be a first level of sensor computing, and later on, in parallel, we can develop some other things which could implement the solution and increase the quality of the, not the quality, but the accuracy.
I think there are a couple of things in here that are really important. The first thing is you need to be connected to it with a customer. If you're not connected with a customer, you will fall in love with the tech you're doing, and that is just gone. You're toast, right? And that is one of the problems when you come home to the mother company or the, you know, the parent company, and they say, so, okay, we're in love with, and the first question the senior manager will ask, so what kind of problem does it solve? You know, you have a customer journey to show us? Do you, you know, what is it? And we're, as I said, from the beginning, we're close with our customers. So we had a fair idea. What is a simple customer problem that is really out there that we can, you know, look at? What does it solve? A customer problem. Simple one.
Yeah. So if you buy Seiko products, right, you can buy 30,000 different products, right? So you have to have a big catalog that gives you the data sheets, right? And you get there and you thumb through and you're like, is this what I'm looking at? Can I use this with this, right? So it's fairly complicated. You can make a lot of mistakes. And you can go to a website and type that in. But if you have human error, you type in the wrong number, and it's only Seiko products. So the customers are really challenged just to figure out, can I use this with this? Are these two things compatible? You know, do I have the tools in the shop today in order to do the job? So your boss will come to you and say, Jim, we want to give a quote to, you know, BMW to make some parts for them. I think we have the tools in the house. I mean, we bought some. Do we use them all and we don't have any more? So just that basic inventory management. Do I have the right tools, the right people, the right machinery today, right now, to give this customer the quote that we can turn this part around in 24 hours. So this, all this does is replicate what you could do manually with a catalog. So you take this device now and you actually touch it to the tool. And there's a little sensor on the tool now, a little, you know,
it's
a
digital tool.
Yeah. And they call it bump, I call it kiss. You kiss the tool, boom. All of a sudden on your phone, you see all the attributes that you're going to need to do your job. And you can test if that's going to be compatible with the other components you're putting together. And you find out that you don't have all the tools in-house to do the job. So it's just that simple, error-free way that you can start to understand, this is the data sheet, this is a... Now, interesting things happen as a result of that. Now, every time I click my tools, and every time he clicks his tools, I'm creating my own tool inventory. Mm-hmm. So again, as you're the boss running the shop, you don't even know, do I have any... Did I buy too many of one thing and not have enough? You know, I want, the customer wants chocolate, all I have is vanilla, right? So you don't have that. So if you ask the guy in the shop, hey, can you stop doing work and getting parts out for the customer and go and build it? Yeah, can you do inventory? People are like, no, I'd rather have, you know, oral surgery, right? Can you, you know, I don't want to do inventory this weekend. So just freeing up the individual operator to be able to still do his job and be productive and all that, but now have the ability to collect what's really in the shop. And now, by the way, it's very interesting when you're clicking on this button, you're showing your own tool inventory. Your boss can see, you know, everybody's inventory in the shop, and then you see where it's located on a map. So,
were you working on something like this in
No.
No. So what was it that came to you, you know, the inside?
Divine inspiration, you know.
Yeah.
You
stumbled on a crack.
No, it was on the meeting room. I was alone, talking to my computer. So yeah, we have to do that. No, but seriously, it was like that. It became quite obvious for me to know it like that. No, but I would say our core business, We are developing some hardware products. So that is the hardware physical, it's a physical world.
Right.
And they ask us to develop something with IoT and develop things on based on the digital environment. And we arrived to the analysis where, okay, there is sometimes these two worlds are in parallel, but they are not very well connected.
Mm-hmm.
So how to create an automatic link between these two worlds. And maybe the entry point was maybe the first things we do, and that is we do that for almost everything. It's just when I create something, I just want maybe to give a name to this thing I create. When we become parents, the first thing we see, we do is we give a name to the baby. Mm-hmm. And if you create that, change that, if I create a prototype of something, I will give attribute a name. When you create a new file on your computer, you will give a name to your file. That means we are already doing that, and we arrive to the conclusion, okay, maybe the first level of digitalization we have to provide is maybe provide and be able to identify every physical product and give them a name, so we want to identify them on our digital database, and then based on that, later on we'll be able to develop some extra services and feature thanks to artificial intelligence.
No, this is the question part. Yeah.
In fact, they are not so much. It's extremely limiting because here, okay, we are able to see a lot of people connected to IoT, sensor experts, and we have all the big and famous companies.
You already had close customer contact. You have a problem. This is really accurate because Sandvig and Seiko, they have a ton of data. They're probably doing the most data mining. So they talk about research and understanding where the bottlenecks are in the factories, and they're doing a lot of productivity studies and helping customers. And so these are one of the things that come up common all the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, I want to say this differently, I don't think they're different than a lot of manufacturers say, you make a batch. You know, that this week I made all of these in this factory, but why do we have to recall 800,000 cars when it's really only 5? Because I can't individually identify and signature and fingerprint every one of them. So you can't change, you can't improve what you can't measure. So that was almost the first dilemma that we had. If we're going to sensor up that tool, machine, and this one, how do I know which is which? So if I couldn't initially fingerprint or identify every single component, so I think this is the challenge across all manufacturing. I really wish I could trace every single thing in the medical pharmaceutical industry where we have to know exactly all the way back. But, you know, it's electronics. We make one laptop and it's exactly the same as the 50,000 other ones that we made today, and there's no individual signatures or fingerprints on it. So that was actually, oh, wow, we've got to solve that problem first. We're never going to get anywhere with sensors on tools if we can't uniquely identify each individual one. So it was almost like staring you right in the face.
Yeah. Part of the thing you're developing is this is a physical product. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of software. You said, yeah, now you can call them an Apple and an iPhone and so on. So do you do the software internally, or do you work with bring partners in?
Yeah, we
use the UX and so on.
I know we use some partners.
And your partners.
In fact, we took the lead of what we want to do, where we want to go,
right,
and after our partner do the work for us, the technical work, because yeah, I'm not able to program in applications. It's not my background.
Right.
But I will be able to play with the app, and I will be able to tell them, okay, that it's okay, that
so
I want
to. So did you find those partners here, or
yes,
in
thanks to Jim and...
But that's
and
the smartest way to do it, because I see two extremes. Otherwise, they go out, the traditional company, and they hire a couple dozen app developers and data architects. They've never built a digital product before, so now there's a bunch of people sitting around arguing, what should we do, and how should we do it, and I call it shining the flashlight in the dark. So I think they did it a much smarter way. Say, hey, we're not going to go out willy-nilly, just hiring, you know, app developers is, you know, very difficult. So I think they brought in the expertise from the traditional business, and we augmented it. Now we know, oh, we need an app developer, right? But we didn't know that when we started.
It's very much the same line of thought, why acquire a company in digital space when you have
right.
No idea where you're going to go, right?
Right.
Returning to your question, talk about one thing, but the other one is, what is a senior leadership team there to do in a company? Are they there to review and possibly kill ideas that are coming up, or are they there to support them? I think that is one of the key things that you need to decide as a leadership team before you send anyone away. You know, what is our job? What is my job? Okay, if printing goes on, and now we have a number of layers between ourselves, but anyway, but if they go on this whole tangent and you know, just spoils money, or on a direction that we are not going to go. The idea might be right. Okay, great. But if there somewhere when in that direction, my job is to support as far as we, you know, as we can go. And I think that mentality in the companies that you might interact with, that is something that, you know, you need to be introspective about. What are we here to do? Maybe also sort of a culture change. I think those two.
But it's the things that make us a big company, the scalability, you know, the you can take an idea for it. That's the things that make the life nimble, right? The purchasing departments, the marketing departments, the legal departments, all that, those rules and regulations start to make you. So
yeah.
I think that all companies have this challenge, right? How do you stay nimble when you've built in all these procedures and forms and policies?
Yeah.
Which you, on the other hand, need in order to run a company efficiently.
Yeah, you're going to have thousands of people in a company. People can't just willy-nilly spend money. You've got to have some purchase orders or control, you know, some way of managing. So I think the things that make big companies successful are also the things that hinder them when it comes to
To your point, which would be so interesting to take part of this future of work, because I think we've been dipping in a lot on, you know, what is our vision of future of work. So I find that it's extremely interesting topic.
Yeah.
Because it's changing, right? I mean, overall, this is changing, and it's changing rapidly.
Oh, yeah.
So I
have a lot of friends who are looking into this and writing books on this.
Yeah, so maybe we could have you back, and we would look at the future work.
Yeah.
I mean, that, again, is a series of things. You know, you're getting different perspectives on it.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing is for sure, it's changing rapidly.
Yeah.
And there are lots of different ways you can look at it. And
I'm curious. You know, we talked a lot about what you guys have learned from Silicon Valley. So my question to you guys would be, you know, what can Silicon Valley learn from a company like Facebook? Or what can Silicon Valley, what should they be thinking, you know, ultimately learn from companies that were started in 1920 or 1930? Sort of, you know, maybe it's not a one-way street, but what does that mean?
I think it's a whole set of business opportunity. I don't know if it's so much of learning, but it's a lot of developing. If you take companies in the range of, say, 500 million up to 5 billion, maybe. I mean, there's a whole niche, maybe not 5 billion, but there's a whole niche here that Silicon Valley could actually cater to, which is not catered to today. Because these companies might not be hunting for startups. They might be looking for something else. And there are very few, and now we're sort of killing your business idea over there. But anyway, there are very few in here, in my opinion, that actually can give a decent support to that kind of size of company. Maybe more in the $500 to $1.5 billion range. So what are you going to do? And I had a lot of conversations through networks. You know, what are you doing as a $1 or $800 million company? You cannot start a black ops. That is impossible. And so what are the startups going to give you? Okay, so do you want to, you can go into sort of a whatever startup or accelerated part, but is that really what you want? I see very little of that, you know, providing that kind of expertise to companies. That is not so much about learning here, but that it might be more sort of the business opportunity side. How do we do that? You know?
I think that's true, because from here we focus so much on startups and the companies that are taking off, the platform companies that are dominating.
Right.
And then there's a whole space in between. In Europe, I think we call them SMEs.
Mm-hmm.
A small and medium-sized enterprises, or there's a big range.
Yeah.
But I think in Europe, there's a lot of attention to that, because in European countries, those are also the companies. Germany is built on SMEs. SMEs is what makes Germany.
They have a name for, like, the miracle companies or something, right? There's some name of that size that is really driving the European economy.
Yeah.
I remember recently there was over 850 companies in Germany that have been in business for 150 years.
And in fact, if you look at Fraunhofer is the world's largest research and consulting organization. It's a little bit like SRI, but 10 times as big as SRI. Mm-hmm. And we And I think they, at least the way I see Fraunhofer, first of all, they have like a dozen different operations around Germany, and they work a lot with SMEs and helping SMEs take, you know, deploy and exploit technology that they develop in Fraunhofer. Fraunhofer is very advanced in what they develop, and that's very hard for SMEs to take and do things with. So Fraunhofer works with SMEs to help them understand how they can take advantage of these technologies, which I think is kind of unique. I don't think we have anything like that. We have DARPA that is working with next-generation technologies for big companies, but SMEs is kind of a black hole.
Well, what seems to me like...
You could make a case that
the national labs maybe do that?
By Rattel, which was a lab that took the idea that Carlton had in terms of the photocopy machine. That was outsourced to a Fraunhofer type for a position.
I think Fraunhofer is interesting, coming back to you on that, but is interesting. However, what they're not, and we are working with Fraunhofer, what they're not doing, they're not providing partnership opportunities. They're not providing an open space. You might have common projects, but it's so far away from what you can experience here. And I see basically very, very little opportunity in Europe right now. There's a vibrant startup scene, but for these sort of mature, maybe a little bit above the SME side, there is very little, and there is actually quite a number of those companies. So, I don't know.
That's an opportunity for Bramo. You need to advise Bramo.
Yeah, maybe I should. I don't know.
Well, I think there's also sort of an interesting connection, maybe back to around the future of work, and that's a really good question, and especially in the industry like manufacturing or even in the service industry, you know, it employs a huge amount of people. So what does the future of work look like? And I think my question is kind of what can Silicon Valley learn from the Bay Area or the legacy companies? They've been employing, you know, people for hundreds of years. So what does that, you know, structure look like, and how do we think about transforming the next generation of people, not just about technology or just about IoT sensors and things like that, which is all part of upgrading that, but what does this all mean for the human being, right? It's just a thought.
Well, there was a big conference yesterday that looked at the issue of augmenting things. You know, there's all this thing, the fear about technology displacing people, and I assume many of you know about Doug Engelbart at SOI, who did the mother of all demos in 1968. He was all about augmented intelligence and how machines could augment the individual, not to displace the individual, but augment what the individual can do. There's a whole day-long conference yesterday looking at augmentation and what is happening with data and
people
are important. You can't take them out of the equation. So how can you help them? How can they work with the AI and so on? The AI should not displace them. And so I think there's a lot of things happening there. And I think the Nordics are kind of interesting, maybe a petri dish for that kind of thinking, because in the Nordics is a strong union still, at least compared to here.
Yeah.
So they you know, think of your workers. You can't just displace the workers. What is the worker? How can you help the worker advance and work with the machines and so on? So that whole part of the change, you know, in the future of work.
Yeah.
How can that, you know, be done in a way that, and I think the Nordics can. I suspect that the governments in the Nordics will be much more inclined to work with that, more so than perhaps you would see here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tradition for that.
This project that you sent to Silicon Valley for 6 months, it's the first time you did something like this. It was the outcome of the visit.
Yeah, and the, yeah.
Have you repeated that process elsewhere? Did you send somebody to Munich?
No.
Did you send somebody to Bangalore?
No.
Okay.
But what we have done as outcomes from these projects, or these learning expeditions, is that we have a fairly large ongoing collaboration with an Indian and a Danish company that came out of the Bangalore part. From the German part, we actually started partnerships with two machine tool builders. So there have been different things coming out of these expeditions, and that is, again, we haven't set ourselves on saying, you know, what should the outcome be.
No.
We've tried to keep the program. It's more, yeah, that is a good word. I mean, it's more discovery on, you know, if I had, looking back, we should probably have put a similar project that we did in the water during this year. Somewhere that we haven't done that. That is one of these things that still lands my mind. But yeah.
How much would you say that the outcome was very positive?
Yeah.
Was a matter of serendipity. And it's a serendipity in a different way. In the sense that the selection process could take good time. He didn't have an overhead with lots of children. He was interested in a town. He was in a town of 18,000 people, and he must believe, get out of town for a while. He got married. Were you engaged at the time?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe there were some interesting opportunities for that. If you sent somebody here who, from the impressions that I'm getting, he's ideally suited to take advantage of the water supply here, to dream about something that turned into reality and came back to you guys and said, this is something that I've developed that I think is really going to have an interesting, positive effect on our business.
Mm.
And the company said, yeah. You're right. It's got a lot of potential, and keep working on it. Let's continue that. I'm not sure that it can be replicated everywhere.
I'm not sure it can either. However, I'm entirely convinced that, and that's why I said we should have done it again in 2018. And I sure hope that we'll get it into the water during next year. I think there is so many inside the company that they're definitely not the same as you, but given the opportunity, people will grab it, right?
So I
have this firm belief that we can replicate this. It might not be the same. We don't even know that this is how it works. But I can also see across the company what this has changed, because people will say, you know, okay, we're changing the process inside R&D given the outcome of this project. So that's one thing. We're much more open to sort of the outside in within the company. And people say, you know, we did it over there. What is to say that operations cannot do it over here?
Yeah.
That is sort of, you've got a stone rolling, right?
So are you sharing, we talked about the communication to the rest of the whole company. Look what we did, and here are some of the things we learned, and we want input. And
you were actually on sort of a tour series when you come back talking about this was the experience, this is what we learned. You know, we that was planned beforehand, that they need to come back and talk about it.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's really important to share that.
And we could have done a lot more. Yeah. We could have
incentivized all the people to say, hey, I want to do that. I have ideas. I want to.
He became an evangelist and went on a roadshow and did a lot of that stuff, showing off what he'd done. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
I think it's definitely one of the challenges for sure.
And then you got to build the platform, so it's not just one project a year. You know, you need to build a platform that this is actually useful for a larger part of the community, which takes time.
Cool. I use an analogy. They came over here and got a boost of jet fuel.
And now they're trying to figure out how do we continue to drink jet fuel. So the one thing took off, and I was like, whoa.
I guess I wonder. I mean, I think we all have in mind the experience of zero carbon. What opportunity zero had.
They dropped the ball.
They dropped the ball. I mean, they tried to build an infrastructure to protect those people. No invoices. No, if you want something, go buy it.
Yeah.
Just go do it. And yet, the folks back in Rochester spent a lot of money on photocopy machines and just couldn't get the idea of what was going on around here.
I was there, and I voted to give all that software to Jobs, right? I agreed to give all that software to Jobs. I
but John saw it. He saw it, and then he got the demo. You know, Bob Taylor agreed to, to show him, right?
But it wasn't what the myth is. It's an urban legend where she must have wanted to support the bad boy stole it from Gerard Park. Nothing could be
No.
He sold the department down. We gave it to him willingly. And $1 million, which were our founder shares of Apple. And we said, here, we're not in the consumer business, which they weren't, right? They didn't know how to sell something to a consumer. So Steve Jobs is a better receptacle for that, right? But I think the best one, I was at Kodak when we decided not to go into the digital camera business because it was never going to be as good as film. So I think a lot of times you're seeing the opportunity, but it doesn't fit into your core business. Xerox didn't have a sales force that could sell something to a consumer. We sold business to business. So I think that it was...
The culture, though, and the risk profile of management, if he had to come back to this
Yeah, it was all a waste of time and effort, right? Would you have to think
we had we had three out of four anyway. The network, the way how to operate, the way of working inside the company. So we had three out of four. We hadn't got
had some good
because outcome. It wasn't only get an MVP buy.
Right.
So it was soft and hard.
Yeah.
But I must also admit, we've had over the time also debate in the leadership team. And especially now, because there was a question in here that you bounce around, so okay, you spend a million bucks or $1 on the ideation phase. How much do you spend on getting into market, right? And that 1-7 ratio, we're not there yet. But of course, people will say, are we really going to invest into this? But there is where we are operating where our targets coming back, because we are operating the targets on three time horizons. Next year, 3 years, and right now it's 2025. Mm-hmm. And in that 2025 time frame, we actually have a guiding target talking about digital. And a guiding target saying we should have 15% of our revenues from non-product related services. Mm-hmm. So we have sort of made a commitment to ourselves and to the company that we're going to develop a business that is not based on physical tools.
Mm. Maybe that's the lesson we can learn from Europe and Silicon Valley, having a longer term, fail fast, pivot, throw it away, start over so quickly here.
So that is sort of where we guide the company on. This is a journey. Maybe there will be a new team that comes in. We don't really believe in that anymore. Scrap it. But for the moment, we have it.
Yeah. And you could probably make the case that the leadership team at Apple is actually thinking beyond.
There are a number of companies out there which definitely have a longer time horizon.
Oh, yeah.
And some of these that have transformed, and I'm thinking about Unilever, for instance. They've been around for 130, right?
Yeah.
And I think they have remade the company 3 or 4 times over this time period, and they really shifted. And they certainly have a longer. I have had a couple of conversations with the leadership team there, and they're at least on a 10-year, but it's not fixed, right? Mm-hmm. But they have an idea.
One thing that I when I read when you sent something on what you were doing and so on. And I, when I was reading part of it, I thought about Vodafone, because I don't know if you know what Vodafone did here in the Valley. They set up an innovation studio, because you mentioned about you want to do something with customers, bring customers more in. Vodafone did exactly that, and they had a this innovation studio, enterprise studio, down close to Oracle, and they were here for a number of years. I'm not sure if they're still active here, but they were bringing customers in here, working with customers, and helping them innovate and leverage what they have learned from their innovation journeys. So. I don't know if you thought of bringing customers in and innovating together with them in like an innovation lab. So
it would be great to have that.
I could share some of the things from Audible, and maybe you can touch base with them. What did you learn from that? What worked? What didn't work? Because if you're trying to
get... It would be fantastic to get customers in to, for instance, to an I here and just have that kind of thing going on in a sort of a multi... dimensional environment with just having part of customers, but not just interacting directly with the customer only, but you know, feed that other partners into that as well.
Yeah,
that would be.
Okay. Are we? Now,
prepare
we have a tradition in my space. I designed a something here. We need to. To get you, we will put you into the Silicon Valley Hall of Fame. You know, in football, they have a Hall of Fame when you're a superstar. And you will now be part of the Silicon Valley Guru Club. So, Quentin,
here is your certificate that you can put on your wall and show your
white
girl.
Wow.
And here is your under.
Thank you.
And we got one for you too, John.
Oh, wow. Because
you've been a part of it. So
now you're part of this very exclusive club of Silicon Viking Gurus.
Yes.
And for our visitors coming from.
Oh, my goodness.
We have
how are we going to bring this home?
One for you.
There.
Thank you very much. Race Creek.
And there's something to drink while you're admiring your certificate. So. I need to get you a bottle later. So. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great session.
Very good.